Insects get a lot of credit for their pollination work, but there's another very important service rendered by insects everywhere that most of us take for granted: decomposition. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis will be here, and we'll talk about the scavengers and decomposers that take care of one of nature's dirtiest jobs. We'll find out about some of the key species when it comes to decomposition and what our earth would be like without them. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran will also be here, and he and Donald will answer your questions about plants and bugs. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and in a few minutes, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran will join us to answer your plant questions. But we're going to start today with a conversation about the process that makes it possible for us to grow all of the wonderful things in our yards and gardens: decomposition. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity. Good to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And decomposition is not a process that just takes place magically when a plant or an animal dies, right?
Well, it's magic to us because we don't have to do it. And decomposition involves lots of different organisms. We shouldn't make this sound like it's only an insect topic, because there are also fungi and bacteria, various other microorganisms that will be involved with the process, but the insects are there first. They're the ones that start this whole decomposition. Now, if people aren't happy with the term decomposition, we could be quite trendy and just call it recycling. What the insects are doing is helping nature recycle materials that are no longer alive, no longer functional, no longer really useful to the ecosystem in their present form. So insects are there to help break them down and get them back into the food web.
Now, you mentioned, of course, there are a lot of other factors that go into decomposition. When we look at an event where decomposition doesn't occur, it is characterized by the lack of insects and all of these factors, like mummification and fossilization, places where the insects can't get there and nobody else can either, right?
Nobody else can either. Another example of that is petrified wood, that if you think about being out in the deserts of the Southwest United States and seeing these huge logs that somehow when they dropped and died, they calcified, they turned into a rock instead of decomposing and turning into nutrients that the rest of the ecosystem could use. So yes, there are examples, some of them quite gruesome, where things get buried or something happens that they don't decompose and they remain intact. So the nutrients that were in that item are unavailable to the rest of the ecosystem.
Let's talk about dead animals first, probably just because it's the grossest. You mentioned the insects get there first. An animal dies. What are the first insects on the job?
Probably some of the flies. There may actually be some microorganisms that go to work first, but when you think about passing roadkill and it's covered with maggots and you wonder, how did they get there so fast? It's because there are specialists. There are flies whose role in the ecosystem is to discover dead animals, to discover death, or to discover manure in some cases, almost instantly. So within seconds to within minutes, there will be flies visiting the remains of a dead animal and begin depositing partially grown larvae on that animal, and those larvae go to work immediately helping to break down the tissues.
So I have often wondered how the maggots are there so quickly. So they're not just laying eggs.
Some do, some don't. There's a lot of variation here, but there are some flies that hatch their eggs internally, and they kind of hold them in suspended animation until the food source becomes available, and then, you know, pop, 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 here come the larvae that are immediately ready to go to work feeding.
And what is their job? What do they do?
Well, they're some of the first to sort of break down the tissue. Oftentimes, they have to use existing openings. It's not like they can dig in. They don't have the teeth to rip and tear apart. They can't penetrate the solid skin or the solid leather of an animal. So they will be at the natural openings, and what they're doing is releasing enzymes that are beginning to digest the tissues. And when that happens, it opens up to other organisms as well. But they're the first there with the digestive processes.
All right. And the flies can find these critters because they are on the move, on the go. What's the next wave?
There are additional flies that come later. There are this group that start immediately, and then as things progress through the decomposition stages, there will be some other flies. Then it's a myriad of beetles that sort of show up once it's been opened up and starting to dry out and decay. There are a group of beetles that show up. Some of them are very specific to corpses. And one example of that, if you know anything about burying beetles, these are beetles who come to corpses very quickly. And at least for small mammals, like a dead mouse or something, they can actually dig and excavate underneath it until it then disappears underground. So they actually have buried it. Of course, that's to their benefit. It helps preserve it a little longer for their offspring to feed and develop. Along the way, things like ants and bees and wasps will also be there, but this progression from flies to beetles is pretty much the role of the insects.
How do the beetles get there?
You know, when it's your job, when your perpetuation of the species depends upon finding the food source that's best for your offspring, they are equipped to do just that through the millennia of evolution. These insects that are specialists on corpses have developed the ability to smell, to find, to detect their food source in the environment, and they are very, very good at it by picking up the odors of decomposition even before we would notice them.
Well, I've often wondered, especially in places where there are lots of roads around and things like that, how the beetles do manage to find in these little islands of biology.
Well, the insects are everywhere, and they are adapted for just that one job. It's not like they have to wait for a tree to die because they're not going to feed on a dead tree. They are specialists, and specialists have to have unique abilities, these unique detection mechanisms, and they have them, and they use them quite successfully.
Now, of course, we all benefit from the work of these beetles because we are in an environment that doesn't smell like dead animals all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also scientists that harness these abilities of beetles because that is the best way to actually clean off a skeleton, right?
In zoological preparations, one of the processes for getting a nice display skeleton, say you had a snake and you wanted to see every piece of every bone, one of the things you can do is confine some of these beetles, such as one that's called the hide beetle or the larder beetle, and these will nibble away at all the bits of flesh that are left on the skeleton. So they can clean it off better than you can do with your scalpel and your scraper, and they will do it very gently, very gingerly, eat away everything that is not bone, leaving you with a pristine skeleton that you can then use for display purposes. So yeah, that's one of the benefits that we have taken advantage of using nature to get where we want to go.
If we've talked about flies and beetles, do we need to go any further with the carcasses, Donald?
Yeah, you know, we're to that point. And of course, all of this happens with roadkill. It happens with animals that die in the woods. It happens with earthworms that die underground, that eventually everything gets recycled unless some mechanism has stepped in to preserve it. But recycling is an important part of the ecosystem, that the molecules and the atoms and the elements and the minerals that are tied up in the body are then released back into the ecosystem where they can be reused by the next critter that comes along.
Now, anybody who's ever cut down a tree or let their grass get too long and then cut the grass and left it laying in the yard knows that decomposition of plant material can take quite a while. Are there insects who help out with that too?
There are some. They probably are not as obvious to us, and there's a lot of microorganisms that are involved with the decomposition of plants. But just to give you two examples of where in the natural ecosystem, insect recyclers are beneficial would be termites and carpenter ants. Now, we think of those as household pests because they begin to recycle the wood that's in our house long before we're done with it. But with a dead log or a dead stump in the woods, out in the natural woodlands, the ability of termites to chew up wood and digest it returns those nutrients to the ecosystem, opens up cavities where water can get in and where decay fungi can take over. The same with carpenter ants. They are chewing up that wood, spitting out the sawdust to make their nesting cavities, and that is opening it up for water and for other decay organisms. So what we think of as a pest in the house is a beneficial recycler out in nature.
And you already mentioned earlier animal waste. Is it the same crew of beetles that take care of animal waste that also take care of carcasses?
No, there are specialists. We have a bunch of insects that feed on fruits and flowers and foliage. I mean, even one that we think of as a major pest in previous years here in Iowa was the Japanese beetle. When the Japanese beetle is chewing the leaves off of the trees or chewing into the fruits, what it's doing is converting that plant material into waste products that are going to fall to the ground and be further decomposed by microorganisms. So they are recycling our tree leaves and our tree flowers and our tree fruits before we're ready for it. But it's all one huge web. It's one big circle that just keeps going around and around. And there are the insects helping that part. So no, plant feeders are generally specialists and animal feeders are specialists. And some overlap, but not a lot.
All right. And once we get through all of this, we've talked a lot about the pollinators and how the pollinators are at risk. We are just as dependent on these cleanup specialists as we are on the pollinators in many ways. Are they doing okay?
Pollinators are struggling. Of course, the story of the honeybee and the colony collapse disorder has been in the news for quite some time, but that has forced us to look at other pollinators. So we're discovering a lot of pollinators that we sort of bypassed in our rush to use honeybees as our sole pollinator. So lots of research, lots of investigations, and trying to figure out how we can help pollinators. All of this can be summed up in a term called ecological services. Ecological services are things that nature does that we take advantage of, things that happen that we think of as a benefit, not necessarily done for us or because of us, but things that just happen. We get food to eat because there are pollinators willing to carry pollen from one flower to another. We have an environment that's fairly clean of dead animals and manure because someone is recycling and breaking that down, and those are good things.
All right. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here. We will continue our conversation in a moment with your questions. If you have questions about insects, give us a call at 866-780-9100. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will also join us in a moment to answer your questions about plants. So again, that number, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join our conversation with your questions about plants or insects. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis and ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here today. And we'll start off with an email question. This is from Nick in Chicago. What should I do with the soil in the large deep planters on my rooftop garden? How can or should I amend the soil before winter moves in to ensure a rich, fertile soil in the spring?
Probably wouldn't do much in the fall, but in the spring I might take some of that out and add some fresh material, maybe some compost, some organic matter, it could be sphagnum peat moss. But I'd probably take some out and bring some organic matter in and then work that into the existing soil.
All right. Another email question. This is from Laura in Cedar Rapids. She says, there is an eastern Iowa slug invasion. I've never seen them so bad. Is this something much of Iowa is experiencing? What can I do?
Slugs happen. And actually, with the droughts that we've had recently, we have talked a lot less about slugs than we did back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. So it seems like we've gone through a period where we didn't have to talk about slugs, but with the rainfall we had in the spring, then we had a little dry summer, which didn't really hurt too bad, but especially the wet weather of August, the slugs came on like gangbusters. And another example of how things can be down for a while, but nature has a way of bouncing back, and that appears to be what has happened. The slugs have bounced back. I think it's more common in the eastern half of the state of Iowa than it is in the western half, but I think everybody is going to see some slugs eventually. Unfortunately, we're at the end of the season, and slug baits are not going to work very well, but those are the choices. We control slugs by eliminating mulch, if that's a possibility, where you're growing the plants that the slugs have attacked. But if you have a slug outbreak, you should have been using slug bait earlier in the season. And once you're at the peak of the outbreak, the baits are not going to work very well, but they work better for prevention. Slug baits are at the garden center. You've got two to choose from. You've got an organic product that contains iron phosphate. You've got a synthetic product that contains metaldehyde. Both of them work. Take your choice, but start baits just before the slug outbreak for best results.
All right, or borrow some neighbor chickens, maybe. This is all you can do at this point.
Yeah, and of course, there's always the possibility of trapping slugs in a pie pan or a cake pan that you have put down in the soil so that the rim of the pan is level with the soil surface. And then this is where you use the cheap beer, not the craft beer, but you put the cheap beer into the pan and the slugs will come out at night. They will be attracted to the smell of fermentation. They'll fall in and drown. It would take a lot of pans of beer to make a difference if you're already at outbreak mode. But if you didn't have very many slugs, that would be one way to help reduce the population.
And it might just give you a sense of satisfaction.
You wake up in the morning, you go out, you rush out to check your slug trap, and there are a few slugs that have died in the beer overnight, but at least they have smiles on their faces having died drunk. So, it's one way to approach a problem. I never think of trapping as a way to eliminate a problem, but it's certainly one way to maybe make an impact and, like you say, have fun in the process.
Right. All right. Let's go to the phones. Don is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Don.
Good morning.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, with the two waves of black flies that we had this year, I wonder if black flies have any natural enemies or predators, and anything we can do to promote those.
I am a natural enemy of black flies, but...
Yep, you swat everyone you can.
They're so satisfying to smack between my hands.
Yep, and compared to some other insects, they're moderately easy to catch, at least. Black flies emerge from the river. They're in running water. They're not in standing water with the mosquitoes. They are in running water, and as larvae under the rocks in the river, yes, they have some predators, they have some parasites, there are things in the water that are part of the ecosystem of an aquatic river system, and they have those predators. Once they get out into the adult stage, there's not going to be much that can eat them. So we have to rely on the natural controls that are in the water rather than the controls that are above ground where we are. Coincidence of circumstances led us to those outbreaks this year. It's been a long time since we got to talk about black flies in the eastern half of the state the way we did this year. Let's hope it's a long time till we talk about them again.
All right, Don, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, let's go to another Don in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Don.
Good morning. I have a question for Richard about trees and grass. Last application of fertilizer for lawn services in the fall was to stimulate root growth in grass. I was putting a new tree in, and the person was telling me that late growth is not good for trees. He talked about some splitting and stuff that had occurred because of stimulated growth. I was curious about first year and succeeding years. Is that a real issue?
Well, as far as the tree is concerned, you don't want to fertilize, let's say, around midsummer because you don't want to encourage late season growth. But if you fertilize in the fall, it's not going to harm the tree. The tree roots will keep on growing until the ground freezes, so there is some benefit there. So we typically don't have to fertilize trees because our soils tend to be quite fertile, but if they get some extra fertilizer, they should be fine.
Okay, thanks.
All right, Don, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Susan in Fairfield. Hi, Susan.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I got a question about ticks and I believe sawfly caterpillars.
Okay.
What about ticks is we have not seen many ticks like for the last month, and we're very grateful, but we're wondering why.
Well, I think ticks are seasonal, that we primarily see ticks in the spring, and that's just a coincidence of how they grow through their life cycle of three stages and how they come out kind of in the spring, anxious to feed and get to the next stage. Also, dry weather discourages ticks. So when we hit a dry period through July, that slows down their activity. They kind of hunker down into the areas where they've got moisture and they'll hang out there. So I think this is your observations are sort of the seasonal expectations, although we know ticks are out there and we can get them anytime. But I would say dry June and July may have caused the problem that you saw. And where did you see sawflies?
On dogwood. We've got some red twig dogwood, and they got trimmed, I believe, at the wrong time of the year. And all of a sudden, these white caterpillars with blue and green spots appeared,
yep,
like all over these plants, and they're just like, you know, defoliating the plants.
Yes, they are. And as we talked about with black flies, we go through these stages, we go through years, and in my case, it feels like a decade or more since I got to talk about the dogwood sawfly. Now, this year, you are not alone. Others are reporting this same thing. Dogwood sawfly is a wasp larva. So caterpillar was technically not quite the right thing to call them. They are larvae instead. And they do go through these stages where they kind of are white and fuzzy, and then they're dotted, and then they turn into a larger stage that has spots and stripes. So it's one that changes its appearance as the larvae grow and develop. We've not had to talk about this for a long time, but now this year, here they are. So something in the weather caused this one to resurge and rebound. Dogwoods in general are very tough and hardy. You can cut them down and they come back. They do well. This late season defoliation looks bad, but it's not going to be detrimental to the plants. So tender loving care through the rest of the summer, into the fall if it turns dry, some watering, but it's going to be tough to justify using an insecticide to kill them, but, you know, Charity likes to pick things off by hand, and and she thinks that's a great hobby, so maybe you could do that too, Susan.
I like to ignore problems until they go away, Donald. That's really
oh,
mine.
That's right. That works too. But dogwoods are tough, aren't they, Richard?
Yeah, no problem.
No problem. Don't worry about it.
So you can ignore the problem until it gets away.
This time,
perfect.
Yes.
My favorite kind of problem. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. You are welcome to join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis and Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Geron. And next up, let's go to Dave on the line in Morley. Hi, Dave.
Howdy.
Hi, what's your question?
Hey, I'm going to be moving my garden. I got an area that's about 3,000 square feet, and I've kept it mowed, but it's mostly just kind of grass and weeds. What should I be doing this time of year to get it ready for spring?
Well, I would try to destroy the existing vegetation. And you basically have two ways of doing that. One would be to use Roundup, just spray it with Roundup. The other way would be to till it, but basically try to prepare it for next year.
All right.
Now, can I use something other than Roundup? And would it wind up, you know, being a problem by spring, or will this, you know, kind of dissipate by then?
Well, if you use a herbicide, Roundup would be the one to use because it doesn't have any residual activity in the soil. So if you chose a herbicide, it would be Roundup or glyphosate. But if you don't want to use a chemical, then I would basically till it.
Or borrow Charity's flamethrower.
I'm going to head down there this weekend and pick that up.
All right. Sounds like a plan, Dave.
Okay, thank you.
All right, what about a landscape cloth or something like that to throw over the area, Richard?
Boy, 3,000 square feet.
Too big, huh?
That's too big, I
think.
That's
a lot of opened black garbage bags that you're trying to staple down to the ground to solarize.
That would be difficult.
And there's a
You'd
lot
have plastic
wind
bags
to come.
All over the neighborhood.
Right. All right. Chuck is on the line next in Dubuque. Hi, Chuck.
Morning, Charity. I work in the state legislature on environmental protection, and I have a question for Dr. Lewis.
Okay.
We just finished our National Conference of State Legislatures meeting in Minneapolis last month, and for the first time we adopted a resolution asking the federal government to develop some policy and programming around protection of pollinators.
Okay, good.
And I'm wondering what recommendations you would have for what a state legislature could do. What does the science tell us about what we need to do to protect the integrity of our ecological system supporting agriculture?
That's a tough conundrum when you try to think, okay, we want to protect the economics of crop production in the state of Iowa, but we want to diversify to increase pollinators. That becomes a difficult match to make. You know, the easy answer for an ecologist would be to say, grow less corn and soybeans and turn it back into prairie, and pollinators would succeed much better than they are out in corn and soybean fields right now. That's not going to happen. So we have to find ways to encourage pollinator-friendly strips along and within fields. The Natural Resource Conservation Service has been working on this. The Xerces Society, X-E-R-C-E-S is how you spell Xerces. Xerces Society has these plans for pollinator floral provisioning, where you leave strips of native flowers either as your waterways, as your roadsides. So any way we can increase diversity is going to be the best thing we can do. Regulating insecticides is going to be problematic because we use those to maximize the production and profitability of our agricultural enterprises. There would be some people who would say the simple answer is just outlaw insecticides. Well, that's not going to happen either. So we need to look for ways to diversify the environment, reduce insecticide use to absolutely what's necessary, and encouragement of these diverse areas is probably what I would encourage the legislature to try to do.
Are there other crops that have economic potential that have less put less pressure on pollinators?
Wow. You know, we need to talk to the Iowa Value Added Agriculture Group. Certainly they have worked on this as well. Value Added Agriculture looks at a whole lot of things, including alternative crops. There are things like canola that probably wouldn't do as well here as they do in some western states, but they certainly would diversify the environment with a blooming crop at a certain part of time that pollinators encourage. I'm going to pass on that one to that particular group, Iowa Value Added Agriculture Group. Practical Farmers of Iowa is also another group that's working on this, and I've probably offended a whole lot of people by not including them in this list of others that are looking at diversifying agriculture and maintaining profitability. But we have a system that works very well for a great number of people, and trying to change that, like they say, it'll be like moving a cemetery. You don't get any help from those who are already inside.
Chuck, thank you so much for your call. Obviously an important conversation to have, and one we will have in the future on Talk of Iowa.
Lots of times.
Yes. Let's get back to the phones, and Kathy's on the line next from Nevada. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Good. What's your question?
I want to know if there is any reason why we should like Asian lady beetles. They come into the house, they stink, they bite.
But they're a ladybug. They're beneficial as a predator. We love ladybugs. They're bright. They're colorful. They eat aphids. They eat scale insects. They eat white flies off the undersides of your tomato leaves until the heat of October comes and they begin their migration out of the fields. Until then, they were beneficial. So we can love them for what they do in the trees. We can love them for what they do in the gardens. And then we can turn right around and on a hot day in October, curse the heck out of them for being an accidental invader. Until they invaded, they would have been beneficial. So, but
okay.
Everything you said was true about them. Our prediction is we're going to have another year where they're not so bad. We went through some terrible years back, like 2006 to 2010 or something like that, when the side of the house would just turn orange with the bodies of the multicolored Asian lady beetle. We've not had those problems in the last couple of years, and this appears to be another year. Based on aphid populations around the state, aphids, of course, being the food of ladybugs, means if there's not as many aphids, there won't be as many ladybugs. That's our prediction. Come back in October and tell us if we're right.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Kathy. And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Here's a quick question from Laura in Fort Dodge. I have a wild grapevine growing through some tall hedges. How can I get rid of it once and for all? It's driving me crazy.
Okay, two ways. One is to dig it up, which is a possibility. The other would be to cut it off and apply Roundup to it. Apply Roundup to that cut surface.
All right.
The third third alternative, though, is cut it off every week of your life.
That's an option.
You are such a great proponent of these very long-term hobbies.
Long-term
You can hobby. Also start making stuffed grape leaves, and the grape vines are not untasty.
That's
so
right.
you can eat it as well.
Make grapevine wreaths out of it and sell them.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa with Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis, ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Geron. You can join the conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today on Talk of Iowa. With me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Geron and Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. So you can join our conversation with your questions about plants or insects today. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Send your email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Barb is next in Des Moines. Hi, Barb.
Hi. Great show. Thank you. I'm calling about an annual seed that I plant. It's called Moonflower, and it's supposed to bloom at night. And I've planted this a couple different years. I get beautiful vines, but I have yet to ever get a flower. What am I doing wrong?
I'm not sure. Does the plant get enough sun?
Yes, it does get full afternoon sun.
Okay, do you fertilize it?
Yes, with flowering plant food once a month.
That might be a problem right there, in that sometimes when you fertilize, you're encouraging vegetative growth and possibly inhibiting flower formation. So I think in the future, I would not fertilize at all. Not at all.
Okay, even with the flowering plant fertilizer, don't
right.
use that.
Not at all. Not at all. Just let it go and see if it doesn't bloom then.
Okay. Otherwise, do you think it's a sun issue if it's not the fertilizing?
Well, I would say if the plant gets at least 6 hours of sun, it should not be a sun issue. But if it only got maybe, let's say, 3 or 4, then that might not be sufficient. So as long as it has 6 hours of direct sun at some point during the day, that should be fine. So it shouldn't be a sun issue. But like I said, it could be an issue where if it's getting too much nitrogen, it's promoting vegetative growth and not flower development.
Thank you so much for the tip.
All right, Barb, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, we've got Kaylee in Ames. Hi, Kaylee.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I went to work the other day and left the windows in my car cracked. And when I came back out, there was just a swarm of flies. And it's been about 5 days. And they're still in there, and I don't know what else to do besides swatting them or maybe borrowing you, Charity, since you had to kill them. I don't know how to get them out of my car, and they're everywhere.
It's hard to imagine that there would be anything in the car that would allow the flies to reproduce. The other thing is it takes probably 10 days to 2 weeks for most of our larger size flies, to go from egg to adult stage. So I don't think you're raising flies. It's probably just the residual of the ones that came in. Now, we've had this change in weather where it went down in the 40s and then it came back up. And in that time, I think insects sort of hunkered down and they tried to get into protection, but oh, maybe they don't need it, so they're back out. My guess is something about the change of the weather caused these flies to wander into your car and hang out there. I can't picture myself using an aerosol insecticide spray inside my house.
Right. I don't necessarily want to bomb my car.
Or inside my car. No, we don't want to bomb the car. I could see hanging a fly swatter off the rearview mirror. But beyond,
what about fly tape?
That would
fly
look good.
Sticky ribbon. You know, just be sure it doesn't swing over and catch your hair when you go around a curve real quickly. Fly tapes are an interesting thing. They work for some species like housefly. Other flies don't care. And since we aren't real sure which kind of fly you've got, it's worth investing a couple of bucks in one of these fly ribbons. But otherwise, okay, I think I would wait for them to die. Now, the other thing is, if we could seal up the car and park it on a sunny day, maybe it would get hot enough to kill them. But that would be awfully hot inside your car.
So, and have you tried hopping on the interstate with the windows open, blowing them out?
Yes, every day. And if I see one crawling near the door, I try to swat it out. So I don't know what else is left for me to do. So just wait for them to die, I guess.
Wait for them to die. Keep swatting them. Check under the seat to make sure you don't have a decaying sub sandwich under there that would allow them to reproduce. But beyond that, you're doing it.
All right.
Kaylee, good luck. Yeah, thanks a lot for your call.
Speaking of recycling, you know, the flies are in there recycling something unsavory.
How do the beetles get in? That's the question. We need them next. Jeff is on the line next in Des Moines. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning, everyone. I've always wanted to plant a apple tree and was curious what the suggestions might be for an apple tree in the Des Moines area. Hopefully Honeycrisp, since they're so expensive to buy at the store, but I also live in the Beaverdale area. I have a lot of shade issues. I just was curious what they thought might be the best bet for something like that.
Well, as far as a fruit tree, basically you need two things. A well-drained soil, has to be a well-drained soil, and you need a sunny location. Again, at least 6 hours of direct sun. So those two things. As far as varieties, there are so many that we can grow in Iowa, not a problem. What I would suggest maybe is going to an orchard, a local orchard, this fall, and sampling some of the apples and finding one that you really, really like, and then planting that tree.
Can we grow Honeycrisp in the backyard with one tree?
Well, with apple trees, typically we'd like to have two different varieties or cultivars because they're not very self-fertile. So you have to have at least another apple. Now, it could be a crab apple, but you need another apple in the vicinity for cross-pollination, for best crops.
All right, living in town, can he assume that there are enough crabapple trees nearby, or does he need insurance?
Well, that tree needs to be within like 100 feet of the other tree, so it has to be fairly close, not down the block, but in the neighborhood. So.
All right, so two trees is
two
a really
trees.
Good idea.
Right.
And what about dwarf trees? Is that something you're recommending so people can actually reach their crop?
Right. Dwarf trees, semi-dwarf trees, are much better than standard trees in that they bear at a much younger age. They're smaller in size, so you can prune them, harvest, spray much easier. So they're basically the way that you want to go. Also, you can get more in a small space if they're dwarf or semi-dwarf.
All right. Jeff, thank you so much for your call. I hope you find something you love. And next up, Marge is on the line in Corydon. Hi, Marge.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I had a volunteer asparagus plant come up in my front flower bed a couple of years ago. It's come up 2 years now, and it's so big and bushy, and I don't want it there, but I'd like to move it, and I need to know how to dig it up, and, you know, is it very deep and all that sort of thing.
Right. You want to move that as soon as possible in that the longer it stays there, the bigger it gets, and the more difficult it is to move. So I would plan on moving that early next spring. So leave that dead stalk over winter so you know exactly where it is, and early next spring, as soon as the ground is workable, dig it up. It's going to be a fairly big crown there, but dig it up and replant immediately.
into an area of full sun again?
Right, full sun, well-drained soil.
All right,
Mark. Always full sun.
Good luck with that. It's so funny to me that people often have a hard time getting asparagus to take off in their gardens, mm-hmm. and yet ditches are full of asparagus.
Right, right.
Doesn't make a lot of sense. All right, Fred is on the line next in Grinnell. Hi, Fred.
Say last, maybe it was this past winter, I think it was Practical Farmers of Iowa at a workshop somewhere on what one could do to prop up the pollinators. I don't know if there was different kinds of plants or what, but I don't know if they're going to have anything like that again. But I thought maybe that'd be a good workshop for somebody that knew their stuff to put on this winter for people that are really concerned about the pollinators. And I forgot what my other question was.
Well, I have a note here that says you wanted to know why some apple trees have apples on one side but not the other.
Last year the tree was loaded with apples, and last year there was no critters in the apples at all. This year about half of the Yellow Delicious have a fair amount of imperfections in them. So is it the weather that made them?
Now, when you say imperfections, meaning dimples or brown spots?
No, their critter got in it and laid an egg, and there's a worm in there now or whatever.
There are two worms in apples, the apple maggot and the codling moth, and both of them have to have, both of them are usually there all the time, but in varying amounts. And when the weather cooperates with the fly to lay her eggs or cooperates with the moth to lay her eggs, we get more damage. And it's pretty much weather dependent. And somehow that dry spell back in June and July really favored the apple maggot fly, and that's probably why you've got so many of them. Sanitation in the fall of the year is one of the things you can do. Make sure you get rid of all the dropped apples, as in pick them up and get them completely off the property. And more apples one year than the other is just the nature of the game.
Right.
We had an amazing apple year last year, so this year not so much.
Exactly.
All right. Let's get an email question in here. This is from Pat in Manchester. We reseeded an area of our lawn a few years ago, and it's mainly clover and weeds. We'd like to start over this fall and reseed the area. Do we need to kill what's there first, and what's the best way to do that? When is the best time?
Well, actually, it's a little bit late for this year. The best time to sow grass seed is basically mid-August to mid-September, and typically you would have to kill the existing vegetation. Again, you can use Roundup on that or you can till it. But you would typically want to do that probably starting around early August and then reseeding maybe in late August, early September. So probably too late for this year.
All right. And we'll talk about this probably 100 times between now and then. But how about reseeding in the spring?
Spring typically works sometimes, but oftentimes you get more weeds than grass. So that's why late summer is the best, because very few weed seeds germinate in late summer, and so the grass doesn't have much competition.
All right. This is an email from Michael. I'm staying with my grandma in Ames. Over the backyard fence, a neighbor has a dwarf tree. It looks like a citrus tree and has seed pods that look like peanuts. They're turning orange now. I can't identify it. Do you know what it is?
Seed pods that are turning orange.
Okay, maybe.
Okay.
I'm thinking.
Well, Michael, here's your chance to write down an email address. Take a really good digital picture. And the digital picture is good if it meets three qualifications. One is it has to be in focus. Two, it has to be in focus. And three, it has to be in focus. And
send that to Hortline at Hortline at IASTATE. .edu.
All right. And let's go back to the phones. Next up, we've got Jeff in Dubuque. Hi, Jeff.
Hi there.
Hi, what's your question?
Yes, right now, my sedum plants around the house just swarming with just about every flying insect there is.
Yep.
And they're completely oblivious to anything that's going on around them.
Yep.
And I was wondering, what's so special about the sedum right now that is drawing everybody in?
Number one, sedum as a flowering, nectar, pollen-producing plant does not have a lot of competition right now. Goldenrod is still out there, so you should see a lot of flies and pollen-feeding insects on the goldenrod. The asters are probably still in bloom, but when I think of my backyard there's not a lot of flowering plants left. And the bumblebees, the honeybees, the yellow jackets, the flies, they're all elbowing each other aside to get to what is left. And what's left right now seems to be autumn joy sedum.
Sure. All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right, Jeff, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, we've got Lisa on the line in Davenport. Hi, Lisa.
Hi there.
Hi, what's your question?
I've seen these images from Great Britain of insect hotels that people build. They can be very artistic and elaborate or very simple. And I did an activity with some kids for Vacation Bible School talking about Noah's Ark and the creepy crawlies. And we made these, but I was really wondering if they would do any good, if there's any bugs or solitary bees here in Iowa that would benefit from an insect hotel.
It's probably going to have to be very specific to different insects. For example, pollinators like the blue-faced bee, the solitary bees, they may need their, quote, hotel is going to have little tubes that are 3/8 of an inch in diameter, not tiny little tubes, not big tubes. They have to be this specific size for things like leafcutter bees to want to move in there. A similar question comes up when people build butterfly houses. Will the butterflies actually go in there and spend the winter? No, but some other critters like spiders and wasps will build in these sheltered locations. But insects have fairly specific requirements for their nesting, hibernation, hiding spots, and a general structure may not meet the requirements of very many. But certainly when people are encouraging leafcutter bees, they put up a hotel that is a bundle of straws. So that would be their hotel, what it would look like. Yes, we can help them along, but probably it's more fun as an artistic activity, and it's more fun as a statement that says, I like insects, I care about nature, I've done something that will help, even if it's only a little bit of help. So I think you're making a great statement by building these. Unfortunately, the bugs may not care.
All right. And sadly, that goes for a lot of bird houses. It goes for a lot of bat houses, that kind of thing, too. But it's a great way to get kids excited, right?
That's right. And unfortunately, it's not quite as a sure thing as, oh, look, if we plant a sunflower seed in a paper cup with soil, we get a plant. If you build a butterfly house or a bat house, it's not quite as certain that you're going to get the outcome that you hope for. But the building by itself was a project worth doing.
All right, Lisa, thanks a lot for your call. Marilyn's on the line next in Clinton County. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. Quick question. I've got a bee wasp. I'm not sure what it is. I'm having a hard time identifying it. Very aggressive. Loves my hummingbird feeders.
Yeah. Don't we all? You probably got a dozen different things, but there are two major ones. The tan ones with the black abdomens are honeybees. The ones that are bright yellow with black stripes, those are yellow jacket wasps. And in the fall of the year, those and everything else, Jeff was mentioning from Dubuque, everything's looking for nectar for their last big sugar fix of the season. And the yellow jacket wasps are doing that at your hummingbird feeder, just like flies and bees were doing it on his sedums. The bird watchers tell me that hummingbird feeders can be equipped with extension tubes to discourage wasps, but it's never 100%. So try your bird feeder supply store to see if you can get extension tubes.
All right, Marilyn, thank you for your call. Donald Lewis, thank you very much.
Thank you, Charity. It's always a pleasure.
Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Richard Giron, thank you.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. I'm Charity Nebbe, and coming up next week on Talk of Iowa and River to River, it's Iowa Week. All week long, we'll be focusing on unexpected things about Iowa. On Monday, we'll be talking about utopian communities built in Iowa and our allegedly flat landscape on River to River. Next Friday, some unexpected horticulture on Talk of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.